Hello, I'm Father Ambrose Little, the director of the Thomistic Institute. Before we begin the next great TI lecture, a quick word with you. Thanks to donors like you, our content is cutting through the digital noise with the truth of the Catholic intellectual tradition. But we can't keep it coming without your help. If you enjoy programs like the TI Podcast and Aquinas 101, please consider a small contribution of $25 or more. You can use the link in the description or visit our website to donate. Your generosity ensures that these important programs will continue to lead souls to the truth all over the world. So please enjoy this episode, and may God bless you and keep you in His grace.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I'll begin with a brief story. It's about conflict over the content of curriculum at a major institution of higher education. But the year is 1229, not 2025. In that year, the newly established University of Toulouse in France sought to lure students and teachers away from the big city to its own institution, which was about a tenth of the size. In a place about the tenth of the size, a renowned teaching master named John of Garland decamped from Paris to Toulouse and hoped others would do the same. The University of Paris had placed restrictions on public teaching of Aristotle, which made Toulouse look more appealing. Garland described the opportunity. "Those who wish to scrutinize the bosom of nature to the inmost can hear, in Toulouse, the books of Aristotle that are forbidden at Paris." Now, this is a page from Commentary on Aristotle's Metaphysics, which was one of the books that was forbidden. As an evocative image. Okay. In the end, scholarly zeal for Aristotle in Paris itself meant that the restrictions became a dead letter there, and Paris, in the end, placed the philosopher at the heart of their curriculum, like the upstart rival in Toulouse. Now, this story of young people leaving the big city behind to go off the beaten path in search of knowledge in remote places may strike a few chords with you here at Dartmouth. But I won't talk about the Middle Ages. Right? Universities were created there and are certainly one of that period's most significant legacies. In many ways, they came into being to harness the intellectual energies that are on display in these jealousies over Aristotle. The university took shape in the way it did because of certain assumptions about what education was for and how it ought to be accomplished. And it's these underlying assumptions and ideals that I want to explore tonight. As you're, of course, aware, our own time is one of significant debate about the nature and purpose of higher education. Questions about academic freedom, the formation of citizens, intellectual diversity and rigor, the return value on high tuition bills, all these are issues swirling in the air, and therefore an indication of our own need to reflect on various visions of what education is for. Because it's a question worth asking for all of us who teach and study at a university. What are we doing here? Why should we be here? So I hope I can help you think a little bit more about this, about your own studies and your own institution, by turning back to the beginnings of higher education. So the title of my talk speaks of a broad swath of time called the Middle Ages, but I'm going to look specifically at the 12th and 13th centuries in Europe, which are the period when what we know as universities emerge. So why is it helpful to look at the beginnings? I'll give you two justifications. There may be many, I'm going to give you two. The first justification is the broader perspective we gain from looking at history. And I think actually C.S. Lewis put it particularly well when he was encouraging the study of old books. And he said, "Every age has its own outlook. It's especially good at seeing certain truths and especially liable to make certain mistakes. We all, therefore, need the books that will correct the characteristic mistakes of our own period. Not, of course, that there is any magic about the past. People were no cleverer then than they are now. They made as many mistakes as we do, but not the same mistakes." And that's C.S. Lewis. I think he's right. I'm not about to offer you a blueprint of perfection, right? But rather a point of comparison. But on this topic of education, there's a second reason for looking back. Dartmouth College is one of the many descendants of these original universities, which means that it is also your past, right? Simply by virtue of you being here. So I hope to offer you a brief glimpse of your roots. In order to say what universities in the 12th and 13th centuries aspired to be, it's important to say what they did not aspire to be. Prior to that period in Europe, if you wanted to learn anything at a very high level, beyond the basics of reading, the only place you could do that was in a monastery. Now, despite what you may have heard about the Dark Ages, monks did not despise learning. On the contrary, they cherished it, and they often devoted tremendous resources to the preservation of ancient wisdom. And here they are slaughtering their flocks for some books. The sheep had to go. They also ran schools in monasteries, schools which taught the liberal arts with the ultimate goal of greater understanding of the Bible. Even though these schools were not often limited to future monks, formal monastic schooling was largely oriented towards formation for monastic life, a life structured around prayer, contemplation, and work of various kinds within the monastery. This is a picture of some boys being given to the monks for school. They're not probably going to be future monks, so they did take in boys from outside. This is Bologna. You can see the monks welcoming these kids. They're pretty young. But most of the monasteries were oriented towards training monks. Monasteries were often located in the countryside. With the growth of cities in the 12th and 13th centuries, schools outside the cloister began to increase in importance. Schools primarily centered around cathedrals. So here's Chartres, which was a major school in the 12th century. So the cathedral is the church of the bishop in a city. And these places taught the liberal arts and philosophy. And easier access to urban education of this sort was like the opening of the floodgates. And what we see in the 12th century is hundreds and hundreds of students flocking all over Europe, looking for talented teachers in cities like Paris and Bologna and Oxford. And why is this happening, right? Well, whole books have been written on this. I'm going to gesture at two reasons briefly. First, you have greater complexity in both the church and the state, what we would call the ecclesiastical and political spheres. They need better administrators to run their organizations. Okay, they need people who understand the welfare, how to promote the welfare of both the sacred and the secular spheres. Okay, the church also is undertaking a massive pastoral effort to educate all of its laity, and this required better educated clergy, people who could perform instruction, preach, teach, go on missions, okay? And these issues were combined with what we might call problems of knowledge, okay? So intercultural contact, most famously in Spain, had led to new Latin translations of Greek and Arabic texts in medicine, science, philosophy, including works of Aristotle's. And we can see, so here's Aristotle teaching about animals. So this is on the parts of animals. Here's Aristotle teaching about the heavens, De Cielo. You can see he's got actually an Arab-style headdress that the Latin Europeans put on him to show that this was coming out of an Arabic transmission through Arabic translators. So he's teaching, you can see he's got a globe there. Right? The growing corpus of these new texts and new ideas awakened medieval scholars not just to the possibility of asking new questions, but also the need to find solutions to new challenges which this material raised. Aristotle says the world is eternal. Genesis says it's created ex nihilo, which is correct. This was a big question they asked. Okay. As these new social and intellectual needs increased, the cathedral schools proved incapable of preparing students for them. And the university emerged in response to the social needs and to these intellectual needs. Groups of teachers started gathering together for study. There was no formal direction for this at first. It was completely informal, organic. But there was a growing recognition of this new sort of arrangement. We can't even say when the universities began. In places like Bologna, Paris, and Oxford, there's no indication of when they first started this exactly. They will later come up with formal statutes, but initially they're just doing it because they want to do it. As they grow more formally, they have a profound impact. This model, you can see, this is 200 years later, you can see they're all over Europe. They're about 80 by approximately 1500. And so if we look at these early communities of learning, I'm going to highlight three main characteristics, three assumptions that underpin them. And there are three ideals that were not always realized in practice, but which as aspirations certainly had significant influence and are distinct characteristics of these institutions. So I'm going to speak of the university, one, as a community set apart for the cultivation of wisdom, both intellectual wisdom and practical wisdom. And I'll explain what those mean, but those are the three things that I want to look at in particular. Okay. So first, a community set apart, right? The university viewed itself as a legally autonomous and enduring self-governing corporate body. Students and masters formed associations to pool resources and influence and to create stable structures that would make teaching and learning more possible. Right? If your teacher just doesn't show up for a lecture, you're not going to learn. Right? If the students never show up, there's no way to, right? If they say they'll pay you next month and they don't turn up, right? All those things make a stable school structure pretty hard. So this was part of what they were trying to do, was to set up standards so that they could actually teach and actually learn. Okay. And they already had a model in medieval society for this sort of association. It's what we know as the guild. Okay. As a group of workers in a particular craft, like goldsmiths, tailors, cobblers, people who unite to set standards of practice and admission to the guild, assure orderly training by masters of apprentices, and elevate the quality of the craft. Okay. And in fact, the word university in Latin, universitas, originally just meant a guild, a collective. And so you can have a university of tailors. Okay, the Universitas Sartorum, right? That's a university. Okay, so you've got the apprentices, the master, right? And that's what it was. Okay, so these teachers, these students, are called the Universitas Magistrorum et Scholarium, the community of masters and scholars. They're professional craftsmen engaged in studium, in study, the craft of study or education. So it was conceived of as a craft. So note that, in essence, this universitas, this community, is just teachers and students alone. Okay. In fact, they didn't even have campuses, really. But it's definitely not career service officers. It's not admissions officers. It's definitely not the football coach. Okay. The community was originally teachers and students. That's it. Right. And that's how they understood their binding relationship. They were a legal status as a guild for learning. Teachers created them so they could teach, and learners, the students, created them so they could learn. The teaching masters had the right within the guild to determine admittance to their community, qualifications for the degree, the granting of licenses to teach, a license that began to be recognized at institutions all over Europe, so it was international. Okay. Bishops, mayors, kings, and popes, like modern-day accrediting agencies, were then called upon to recognize these rights that they set up, the rights of the guild, and they did. Although there were definitely hiccups. Popes in particular often had to intervene to preserve university autonomy, which they did by guaranteeing this status, this self-governing status of the Guild of Learners, to make sure that it was actually not subject to local civil law, but rather to the own university statutes. And this is the beginning of town-gown separation. Okay, and the popes did this, they did guarantee this autonomy by designating every member, including lay people, as clerics while they were studying, right? Essentially setting them apart from civil society and placing them under the church's protection as if education were something like a sacred calling, right? Clerics being the word that was used for those who were in orders for priesthood. Okay. And you can see an early example of this in Pope Gregory IX's 1231 intervention in very tense affairs in Paris. A two-day town gown riot. Okay, which had begun when some drunken students complained about a bar tab. It's true. They thought they had been overcharged for cheap wine. They beat up the tavern keeper. He called his friends. They beat up the students. It was 2 days of this. But eventually, the royal authorities, who were in Paris, had to step in because it was chaos. And they not only arrested the students, but they killed some of them in the process. Now, the masters complained about this treatment of their students. And they threatened to shut down the entire university as a result and leave town, right, if their separate status under church law was not upheld. So they were willing to shut down everything for the sake of their students. Now, Pope Gregory reaffirms this status in order to save the university. He says, "You are special." and he praises the university for being wisdom's special workshop. That's what he calls it. The workshop, right? Like the guild. Workshop, the workshop for wisdom. So the university is set apart as a group of craftsmen working for wisdom. And so that brings me to my second characteristic, right? And part of this work is the cultivation of intellectual wisdom, okay, which was called in the Middle Ages sapientia. And here wisdom is depicted as a woman there supporting the Ark of Heaven. That is sapientia, okay, the highest knowledge. So in less lofty terms than the cultivation of intellectual wisdom, we would say that the university emphasized the sharing and the transmission of knowledge. Okay. that knowledge was called ciencia, or science, right? But it leads towards wisdom. Okay. Animating this was a belief that knowledge aimed people towards wisdom, okay, which is the sort of highest wisdom, as I'll explain. Right? So why are they seeking knowledge? They believed it fulfilled human nature. It was your nature to know. Right? That's what people are made for, and they found this also confirmed in Aristotle, who begins his metaphysics by saying, all people by nature desire to know. Right? So at the very core of your being, says Aristotle, right, is a thirst, a longing for knowledge, okay, which the mind helps you fulfill. And that's why, first and foremost, before any other consideration, professional, economic, political, knowledge was good for that reason, right? Because it fulfilled your nature. And so good was it that Gilles of Rome, one of the great teachers at the University of Paris in the 13th century, he argued, if the lord of a kingdom does not promote study, nor wish his students to become knowledgeable, he is no king but a tyrant. So knowledge can be arrived at by gaining understanding of a particular area, such as mathematics, while wisdom in its broadest sense is the ability to move beyond one particular area. It's a habit of mind that can understand the relationship between different areas of knowledge, right? To judge them and place them in proper order, to understand the relationships between different areas of knowledge. According to the highest principles, right? What are the most important things? Using those principles to see everything. That's at least the definition according to Thomas Aquinas. And since we are here under the aegis of the Thomistic Institute, we should definitely refer to him. This is not the normal image you get of Thomas Aquinas, but that is, in fact, Thomas there teaching some students. Okay. Obviously not an exact portrait. But Aquinas also insisted that the more deeply you know something, the more you will love it. Right? And the more you love it, the more you will want to know about it. And this is a mutually sustaining relationship between love and knowledge that should foster within students a love of wisdom, a love of learning, a love of learning that propels you towards wisdom. Right? So this education ultimately seeks not just mastery of material, but a transformation within the student. So that the students come to know themselves and their relationship to the world. So I'm going to pause for a moment just to point out that the goal of the medieval university was not critical thinking. Right? We hear this phrase a lot, and they certainly thought that a sharp intellect, the ability to analyze problems, these were indeed important, as we'll see even more, right? But they were not held up as the end, but rather as a means to seek something higher. In fact, we might say that the purpose was of this education was not to transform you into a critical thinker, but into a kind of contemplative, right? Someone who would know and contemplate truths. Okay. Now, monks, too, spoke of contemplation as the goal. So what was the difference between monastic life and this university life? Well, monastic life, as I said, was education put at the service of the interpretation of the Bible. The definitive Christian text. And the ideals of monastic study were slow, meditative reading, plumbing the depths of scripture, reveling in its beauty and wisdom. And you can see an example of this embodied in the great composition by the 12th century monk Bernard of Clairvaux. He wrote a commentary on the Song of Songs. And that biblical book has 8 chapters. But after 86 sermons over 18 years, Bernard had only gotten to chapter 3. Right. So, such was the wisdom, the depth, the riches of that text. He was not going to rush it. He was going to meditate on it, plumb it to its depths. So, he didn't care if he didn't get to chapter 4. Right? There was enough in the first 3 chapters to occupy 2 decades. Okay. I have a picture too. So, there's the Song of Songs. This may, in fact, be the Bible that St. Bernard of Clairvaux used. They seem to have traced it, and that is the commentary on this. This is actually the text of the Song of Songs. And you can see there's an embrace of the soul in God. At the very same time that Bernard is working on this, a long time, the very time he's composing all these sermons, right, this alternative approach to study that we see in the university is emerging, right? And to be certain, the Bible is going to remain the most important text in the curriculum, but the early schoolmen were not so willing to subordinate all of their knowledge to study of scripture. And instead, they envisioned a much more systematic, expansive, and comprehensive system of learning. Sorry. And the spirit of this systematic and comprehensive education is summed up by an early 12th century teacher in Paris known as Hugh of St. Victor. And he says, omniadice, learn everything. Okay. There he's telling them, learn everything. Okay, why? Well, he continues. He says, you will see afterwards that nothing is superfluous, and a narrow knowledge is not delightful. Right. You need to broaden, he says. Now, he did not intend by this remark to promote an insatiable appetite for reading anything that comes along at any point. He was instead urging the patient building of foundations, an edifice of knowledge, right? Students who wanted to zip ahead and only study the things that they found relevant or useful, he thought they needed to learn that, in fact, the humblest foundation fundamentals were important for seeing the relationship of all things, right? But this phrase also does highlight the comprehensive ambitions that are going to come to energize the universities in their devotion to transmitting a vast array of knowledge. The medieval curriculum was based on a belief in the interconnectedness of all knowledge, not like links in a Wikipedia page, but as something with an underlying unity grounded in their divine source. And so the attempts of these universities to order knowledge within larger wholes, within a larger whole, was based on really a remarkable confidence that people were indeed made to know the whole of reality, to learn everything. Okay. As if, even if that reality obviously could never fully be comprehended or fathomed, but they were meant to. So, and that knowledge was meant to be shared. Thomas Aquinas defined teaching as contemplata aliis tradere, handing over to others the things you have contemplated. So there's contemplation, but then there is handing on, right? And so you can see in that, so, and Aquinas also insists that that is better than a life of contemplation alone. And so that's evidence of a different spirit, right? This is evidence, the open spirit that is animating university life is in contrast to this inward-focused life of the monastic enclosure, right? So Aquinas, it really has in mind saying, monastic life is contemplation, ours is, we're going to contemplate and then transmit it to others. Aquinas taught at the University of Paris, I should mention that. So let me look at the specifics of this curriculum just for a couple of minutes, right? Because that's of fundamental importance in establishing this way of seeing reality and of being in the world. Okay. The structure of the University of Paris in the 13th century gives us a good general sense of these ideals. There were four schools within the university: arts, medicine, law, and theology. And the faculty of arts was responsible for what we would now call the bachelor's degree. Okay, which was a program of study based on the liberal arts and philosophy, which was the ordered search for these underlying causes and structures. And philosophy was the culmination of the bachelor's degree. Students often entered the arts faculty at a younger age, around 15, in fact. Okay. Prior to this, they would have been taught in some elementary fashion, in their homes probably, much like our basic reading, writing, and arithmetic. But at university, they were taught at a more sophisticated level, and they received the bachelor's degree after several years. It could take as many as 6 or 8. Yeah. But then they graduated the same age, 21, right? So I should note that girls and women did not go to university. Okay. But they were usually educated in their homes or in local schools or convents. Here's St. Bridget of Sweden teaching some women. Okay. Now, there were some very talented women that advanced to the heights of knowledge this way, but only boys and men studied at university. Apart from one extraordinary exception, as far as I know, this is Bettizia Gozzadini. Obviously, it's a later bust of her in Bologna. She, in the 13th century, studied law at the university and became an actual teaching master there. Don't know how this happened or why, but she did, and she's the only one for several hundred years. Very interesting to learn. We don't know much about her, but an extraordinary woman. Okay. But if we look at the liberal arts curriculum, it was inherited from the classical Roman world. And these arts, combined with the Christian emphasis on study of the Bible, were the basis of all medieval education. And they're traditionally divided into two parts. First is the trivium. Here, these are the seven liberal arts, right? Okay. And I'll talk about the three in a second. So the first three are, and this is them embodied, grammar with her club to, it's not a club, it's a sort of a birch thing to get the kids going. Okay. And this guy's about to be whacked, actually, I think. Then you have rhetoric, with the snake, because rhetoric can be used for good or bad pretty easily. You can persuade people one way or the other. Okay, so hopefully she's got the snake under control. And then dialectic was for combative argument. Okay, she's got her shield and her spear there. Okay. So grammar, rhetoric, and dialectic or logic. Okay. And those are the arts of the word that teach you how to communicate, to argue, to persuade, in Latin, of course. Okay. And then you had the quadrivium, which was the fourfold arts of number. Right. So we have word and number. Arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music, which taught you to find the underlying patterns and harmonies that structure the natural world. And this is, here is God, the geometer. This is a fairly well-known image, but you can see he's got everything. That's definitely numbered, right? Okay, he's got his compass. Okay. So if you know the quadrivium, you can figure that out and then learn what God has done. Okay. Study of the arts in Paris culminated in philosophy in your final years under the three headings: natural philosophy, what we now call science, okay, the physical world, moral philosophy, interactions with people, and metaphysical philosophy, the study of all being, reality. Okay. And the bachelor would graduate in their eyes capable of knowing how to read and interpret books, how to read and interpret the world, and how to make judgments about the world and one's interactions with it. After the bachelor's degree, you had a master's degree, which would take another 2 or 3 years, and that was training to teach the arts. So it was teacher training for the arts, and there'd be further study of the arts. After that, only after that, could you go to the higher faculties, those other three. So all that's the arts. That's just the first faculty. Then you have the other three, right? Medicine, law, theology. Okay. And that might take another 6 years. Those are like doctoral programs of sorts, I'd say. Okay. So it's not just the structure, though, but the pedagogical method that helps the students, helped form them as they thought. Okay, so I'm going to speak briefly about the two key methods of pedagogy, right? University instruction in the arts, all the arts as well as, in fact, all the higher disciplines as well. We're based on the lecture, the lectio, and the disputatio, the disputation. Okay, here we have, so here's a lecturer. You can see he's lecturing, the students are following along nicely. This is a disputation. You can see there's a lot of words flying around there, right? They're arguing and they're chatting, the words are all going all over the place. Okay. But yes, that's a disputation. Okay. Lectures were not delivered as courses within topics and departments as we would now have them, okay, but rather on books, just a single book, right? The lecture would be on books. And it would be a course of lectures on one book, okay? So they would explain the thoughts of eminent authorities over the course of many weeks or months. At Oxford in the 15th century, the course on Aristotle's Ethics took 4 months for that book, okay? And Euclid's Geometry, about 5 weeks. Okay. But what's happening in these lectures is not just the transmission of knowledge in a particular discipline, but also the transmission of culture, right? It was the incorporation of students into a tradition of thought stretching back to the ancients, to the very beginnings of each of these disciplines. And you can see this, one of my favorite images. Okay, you have this sort of goddess of learning here, Nicostrata, she called it. She's got her little boy, and that's the ABC tablet. They would often have that go to school with their sort of ABC. It's called an ABCDarium. And then they enter this tower of learning, and at the bottom you have grammar with two authorities, Donatus and Priscian. Then they go up. You get logic, which is, and each of them is represented by an authority, a person, right? And the names are there. That's Aristotle, logic. Then they go over to Tullius, what's Cicero, rhetoric. Then there's actually Boethius, he's obscured, but Boethius is the music. And then you're going up further, you get, and then you get, this is music, well, there must be, so, you have geometry, there must be astrology there, music, and then Boethius arithmetic, Pythagoras music, for noting the harmonies of things, Euclid, geometry, you have Ptolemy, astronomy, and then you get philosophies, and at the top is theology, Peter Lombard. But each discipline is associated with a person, right, and a textual authority, okay? And so that's the way they conceived of it, okay? So it's, I think the key principle, the assumption here is that actually education in this sense is not simply learning how to think. It certainly is that, but it is not just that, right? They believe that the topics students should think about mattered, right? And that there was a body of knowledge that students needed to know, one that placed them in relationship to and in continuity with the past, And they didn't think that they were trapped by the past, but rather sustained and strengthened by it. Again, this didn't mean lockstep intellectual conformity. As we'll see, there was plenty of disagreement and plenty of exposure to a wide range of opinions. But they did think one couldn't really make judgments about the world without the standards offered by these authorities and tradition. Otherwise, one was floundering on one's own. Right? You needed to be led, as you can see. Right? Remember again, the university members conceived of themselves as members of a guild of craftsmen, the craft of teaching and learning. And crafts at any level, whether you're talking about sculpture or playing piano, is passed on not only by techniques, but also by shared judgments about how to do it. What's the goodness of the craft? How do you produce something well? Right? John of Salisbury, who studied in Paris and Chartres in the early days of the 12th century, wrote of his great teaching master Bernard of Chartres, and he offered a formulation that has become fairly well known even today. So John writes, quote, "Bernard used to compare us to dwarves perched on the shoulders of giants. He pointed out that we see farther than our predecessors, not because we have keener vision or greater height, but because we are lifted up and borne aloft on their gigantic stature." There it is. So it's the dwarf, there's the giant. Right. Now, in contemporary American culture, where we're told to think for ourselves, it might not seem like the most exhilarating vocation to aspire to be an intellectual dwarf. You probably did not list that on your application as a reason for coming to college. Nonetheless, what Bernard's image is reminding his listeners of is that one of the first qualities needed as a student, and indeed as a teacher too, was humility. The humility to recognize that others had walked the earth before you and taught things and knew things. Bernard knew that his present age, the 12th century, had advanced in knowledge and could see further than that of the past, right? The dwarf is a little taller. Okay. But only because of the past that his present day could see well. Without access to the past, without learning from it, he and his fellows would simply be tiny people on the ground. And what I've said about the reading of authoritative texts in the university may sound something like the idea of a great books curriculum in which places like St. John's College have been devoted. And yes, they did read great books in the medieval university, although it was not in the mode of a Socratic seminar, which was a much later invention. Instead, the mode was these two things that I've talked about, lecture and disputation. And the lecture, it's very likely that this lecture was a very passive experience. The students simply listened to the master's commentary and perhaps took a few notes. No questions were allowed. Students who had the copy of the text, which was usually not many, might even follow along. Okay. Now, such a method might sound soporific to modern ears, and indeed it sometimes did to medieval ears as well. If you take a look at the guy in the bottom right there, he's out. Okay. You can see his peers are listening, I think, but he's definitely not enjoying this one. Okay. Now, in his defense, I should note that lectures in the medieval university began at dawn. Sorry. That's required a zeal it's hard to imagine today. And students in the lectures, nonetheless, did need to be attentive. So it was not just let the words wash over you. They actually were expected to repeat the lecture by memory later that day. Yeah. So they would go to an upper-level bachelor or the master himself and then give back what had been said. That guy is definitely not going to do it. Okay. But this training in attention and memory was so important, a pedagogical method, that in 1355, for instance, the arts faculty at Paris explicitly forbade lecturers from lecturing slowly enough so that students could take down all their words. We don't want you to do that. We want you to speak normally so they have to get into their heads. Okay. And I like this image. I imagine that this guy looks pretty worried over there. I think he might be falling behind. He's got a little frown, suspecting that he is not following close enough. Now, along with these kind of lectures on authorities, students also participated in a wholly different sort of experience, one that was anything but passive. And instead, it was often freewheeling and even combative. And that's the disputation, something akin to public oral exams or set debates. And it was a weekly period for questioning, for sharpening the reason, for exploring its possibilities. As I said at the beginning, all lectures were a prelude to disputation, and that's what they meant. You had lectures, and then at the end of the week, there would be arguments about what they had heard. Okay. All these texts were significant enough to spur lots of questions. And students were meant to go away from the lecture, meditate on, absorb the text, and then return for the disputation on another day when the master would pose questions or particular interpretations of a problem. Here's one that Aquinas likely posed. Aristotle says in his Metaphysics, something is free if it exists for its own sake. But does this mean if people are created for the sake of knowing God, their minds are not free? Okay, so you gotta figure out, okay, is your mind free or not, right? So that's the kind of question a student would have been asked during the lecture on the Metaphysics. Come back in a few days and discuss, right? Okay. Students would have to give arguments for one side or the other, right? So they would have to actually think about how this could be argued from either side and respond to various objections offered by the master. These were challenging questions, right, which required consideration from multiple perspectives. And the master would then offer a resolution of the particular problem. These disputations were regular occurrences, but it was also used as a process of examination. The bachelors who were preparing to become masters had to do this in front of all the masters of the university. That was the exam to become a master. And here we have, you can see this I imagine is kind of a scene like a disputation, right? One of the students has been called forth and he's posed this question, right? And you see the others are also listening. Okay. Disputation was fundamental to the medieval academic experience, but it did also harken back to the original academy, to the philosophical dialogues of Plato, who thought that truth could only emerge from conversation. All of Plato's works are conversations. Aristotle concurred with this, insisting that if you wanted to find the truth, you must first engage with the opinions of those who judge differently. And actually, they have here a medieval manuscript, Plato and Aristotle arguing with each other, right? Okay. You say that. Okay. Now, those of you familiar in medieval academic hands, a disputation was a mode of thought that prized clarity, categorization, and logical marshaling of authorities. And it's the foundation of what we call scholasticism, which is the method of the schools. That's it. Right. And those of you who are familiar in any way with Thomas Aquinas' Summa Theologica will recognize how that work embodies, in book form, this very pedagogical model. Okay, taking on the pressing intellectual questions of his day, a question is posed, and arguments on both sides are given, okay, and the resolution is offered by Aquinas, the master. Right. So in that process, he is offering also a structured, comprehensive approach to every question that he could think of on Christian theology, right, in arguable, teachable form. And he does so while trying also to reconcile and incorporate the teachings of nearly every major authority known to the Latin West at the time, and not just Christian authorities. Right? This is a reconciliation process that includes dealing with the wisdom of contemporary Arabic and Jewish thinkers, such as Averroes, Avicenna, Maimonides, and along with ancient authorities, Plato, Aristotle. Okay. Other university scholars did the same thing. There are hundreds of summas written. Okay. Thomas Aquinas is the most famous. This is what we could call the research agenda of the medieval faculty. Okay, solving these problems through disputes, distinctions, clarifications, but also attempting to reconcile into a harmonious whole all sorts of potential contradictions. And in this sense, you might call the 13th century the age of reason rather than the age of faith, as it is sometimes called. Okay. Now, such was their confidence in questioning as a way towards truth, that masters in the universities would also hold disputations not in a narrowly focused manner on a particular text with preset questions, but rather like a politician at a town hall meeting, where a question might come on any topic, from friend or foe, your academic rival, for instance. Okay. These were called quodlibet disputations, arguments about quodlibet, whatever you please, literally. On the opening day, anyone, bachelor, master, fellow faculty member, even a civil authority like the mayor of Paris, could show up and ask you a question on any topic. The master then had no more than 2 days to come up with a coherent response. Okay. Remember, this is before, obviously, the libraries are pretty small. Okay. Now, not every master had the confidence to undergo such public testing, understandably. But we do know that Thomas Aquinas did, because we have his published answers to hundreds of them on questions ranging from lofty theology, can a created intellect see God's essence? To more humble, did Christ die on the cross? Can God sin if God wants to? Or pick up the rock, basically. Are we, and then ethical questions, Are we bound to follow conscience, even if it might be mistaken? Is it always a sin to wear expensive clothing? Okay. There are also questions clearly posed by people pondering their academic vocation. If students have heard different masters of theology with contrary opinions, are they excused from sin if they follow the false opinions of their own master? Right. So there's a sort of anxiety over teaching, or being a student, rather. Another question like that. Should a man forgo the study of theology to pursue the salvation of souls, even if he's good at teaching? Thomas thought no. And then there's one of the most evocative ones. I'm not sure who asked this question, but is truth stronger than wine, kings, or women? That was the question. And we know Aquinas' answer. He thinks truth is strongest. Okay. All right. Now reflect on what you might ask Thomas Aquinas if you had the chance. But we should also remember none of these disputations, whether as quodlibets or as part of the regular academic exercises, were simply for the sake of having an argument or of allowing disagreements to be aired. There was always a resolution by the master, right? So the free questioning always took place within a certain structure of tradition. Opposing interpretations were recognized and their clashes could be fierce, but masters always sought ways of finding solutions to these disagreements, of trying to integrate competing claims into a larger whole. So they sought to form thinkers within a community, right? To show them how the community could make sense of the world. This was also the rationale for the requirement that each student had to attach himself to one master. The master's job was to prepare the students for examination, lay out the course of study, but students also associated with that master would form a natural group, right, which allowed for more personalized relationships within, you know, something of an unstructured university. Okay. This arrangement also would help students become inspired to the love of wisdom and knowledge by seeing others love it and seek it. So pedagogy here is relational. It's the pursuit of knowledge that is interpersonal, right? It's based on the bonds of teacher and student and of students with each other. Master and apprentice and apprentices with each other. Okay. The goal of the masters was to spread knowledge, and they did write and publish massive works, such as these summas. But they didn't become members of the university for the sake of independent study and research, so that they could write books for an external audience. The master was committed to the students, turned towards them. Sabbaticals to flee teaching were very rare. Now, the purpose of all these scholastic methods was to teach students to resolve these contradictions they encounter in the world. With these obstacles out of the way, they would, ideally, draw closer to the truth, therefore to God. That was certainly how the masters conceived of their mission. And that's why they placed dialectic, this argument of disputation, at the forefront. It wasn't meant to be an end in itself, but only a preparation for higher knowledge. But it is worth acknowledging that sometimes it became an end in itself, and there were possible flaws in this, right? So this focus on analysis, questioning, and dispute did have problems, right? Even Aquinas, in the preface to a Summa, is already rejecting the excessive accumulation of needless questions, needless articles, needless arguments. So argument could take on a life of its own. And certainly for monks, looking at this whole situation, for them, theological learning consisting of slow meditation over decades on a book, right, reading in the silence of their cells or humbly listening rather than this noisy disputation and speculative argument, they often found the whole thing distasteful and problematic. They wondered, did this knowledge really make you wise? Was this the sort of transformation that one should seek? And even those outside the monastery expressed deeper concerns about the misuses of the mind, about the distorting dangers of narrow specialized knowledge, which produced a sort of intellectual deformity, or could at least, right? In one of the most popular medieval collections of saint lives, the 13th century golden legend, we find a story attributed to a Paris theologian about a certain Master Silo who asked a dying colleague to return after his death and tell him about the afterlife. A few days after the colleague's death, this fellow returns to Master Silo. And just as Jacob Marley appeared to Scrooge, wearing the chains of greed he had forged in life, so did this unnamed scholar appear to Silo, wearing, quote, a cape made of parchment written all over with sophisms. That is, deceptive and misleading arguments all over his cape. Okay. And it was woven of flames inside. And it was a cape, he says, that weighs down upon me more than if I were carrying a tower on my shoulder on account of the pride I had in my sophisms. Right? So he took pride in the power of his arguments, not the truth of them. Okay. And now Master Silo, deeply affected by this vision, goes into his class the next day, recites a poem comparing all of his useless teachings to the croaking of frogs, and enters a monastery. So there's an alternative vision there, right? And later in the Middle Ages, there's a perceived aridity of scholastic dispute and its inability to touch the heart. And that's one of the reasons that the Renaissance humanist Petrarch sought learning in a revival of classical eloquence. No scholastic theologian ever did ask how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, but it's true that of the arts of the trivium, they really gave preeminence to dialectic. And one can certainly imagine the humanist elevation of grammar and rhetoric through poetry and history writing as a needed corrective. Right? And in this way, the humanist contribution to education was a deepening and renewal of the liberal arts tradition. But despite these possible distortions, the early university remained committed to the transmission of knowledge. And I want to turn at this point to my third and final characteristic of the university. Right? So having offered you this image of a community of scholars seeking knowledge, studying for the love of wisdom, I am, in good scholastic fashion, now going to clarify, quantify that, and make some distinctions. Okay. So on the one hand, they did believe in education for the, that was not for the sake of jobs. Right? They would have, like some contemporary critics, called a liberal arts degree useless. But they would have meant something quite different. Right? Insofar as the goal of academic life is to know and contemplate truths, it doesn't point to anything beyond that, to no other use, right? Not even to national GDP. Liberal arts education was not conceived of as a contractual quid pro quo. Tuition goes in, higher salary comes out. Measuring the success of universities based on graduate salaries, tempting as this might be today with the exorbitant costs, was too transactional an approach for them, one which defined people by their productive labor. But on the other hand, they did recognize that university education could be of great service for an individual in the world, but also, therefore, someone who was acting for the benefit of society as a whole. So they did not see it as useless for society, ultimately. So the third characteristic is practical wisdom, right? Prudencia, as it's called, and here's Prudencia writing at her desk. Prudence, okay. This was understood to be the capacity for determining the right reason to do things, not just how things are done, but why. Being able to think not just about means, but ends, especially the goal of a well-lived life. So practical wisdom uses knowledge to good effects, and this was absolutely part of their understanding. Okay. Training in the liberal arts helped cultivate this because such education could produce transformed people capable of a larger vision of the world and their place in it. Liberal arts education affected all choices in life, including the career. It was therefore supremely practical. Such education could not be subservient to particular political demands, but it could nonetheless be of service to the society as wisdom operating in the world. Furthermore, and we see this from the very beginning of the institutions, education was connected to specialized professional training. When universities set themselves up in urban societies and trained lay people who needed administrative skills, as well as good doctrinal and rhetorical skills, they were accepting the pressure of practical demands from the beginning. And here's actually, there's some lawyers training to be lawyers in Bologna in the 14th century. This is from a tomb of a lawyer. So the students gathering in Bologna wanted to study law. Those gathering in Salerno wanted to study medicine. Even those studying theology at Paris or Oxford wanted professional credentials by which one might advance up the church's career ladder. So we shouldn't downplay the transformative and economically uplifting power of university education in this period, power probably even greater than in our own time. Students from humble, urban, or middle-class backgrounds were indeed predominant in the universities, since aristocrats often preferred to educate their children at home, or in the castle, I guess. In an age, for instance, when many popes came from noble Italian lineage and considered being the Bishop of Rome part of their family inheritance, we have the great example of Pope Urban IV, who was born the son of a cobbler, but found his way to Paris, where he studied law and theology, before being named to ever higher positions within the church. And the university was the only way he would ever have become pope. Providing highly trained, highly knowledgeable leaders was part of what the universities did. They recognized that a truly flourishing society needed both liberal education and professional training. Nonetheless, and this is key, they did insist on a proper balance, neither the theoretical nor the practical dominating the other. How did they keep this balance? Career preparation was placed within the larger framework, laid on the foundations of the liberal arts and philosophy. In line with Hugh St. Victor's admonition to study the fundamentals, a student had to proceed through the liberal arts first. And that prevented the higher specializations and their experts from being cut off from this larger body of knowledge. Those who wished to change the world were first urged to study it and get to know it. The higher faculties were not simply training grounds, but deeply related areas of knowledge. Medicine, the study of the natural world. Law, the study of this human society. Theology, the study of God's revelation of being. These are all lofty ambitions for the professions, but they gave a capaciousness to students' goals and placed their success in society within a larger context. Now, you may well be wondering how people actually responded to all these ideals, how they lived up to them. Was this just naive idealism, deluded about the ways of the world? It's worth remembering that this was hardly a naive culture, but rather one acutely aware of the failings of human nature. With its weakness, self-serving, right? We have, here's hell, okay. Not fun. In their mind, people were very weak, very, very possibly self-serving, right? And they placed great emphasis on these failings, right? So yes, these are ideals which they knew could not be fully achieved, which would be a great struggle. And we again have all sorts of evidence of medieval education that shows their awareness of the difficulties, right? We've seen this chat before. There's also this approach, okay? Learn or else, right? But this emphasis on prudence, on ability to make wise decisions was particularly necessary, also because it was evident that many university students lacked it. Remember, of course, these are often 15 or 16-year-olds, and they're arriving in a big city at home alone, okay? Often unprepared for the responsibilities. Sorry, yes. Anyway, anyone tempted to grumble about students these days certainly should take a look at what the Middle Ages students were up to, okay? Some of the town gone incidents are pretty shocking. I'll just give you one. 14th century Oxford, for instance, had a homicide rate 50 times higher than the current rates in English cities, and 4 or 5 times higher than medieval London, which did not have the university. University students made up about 25% of the population and were 75% of the perpetrators of fights, stabbings, riots. Townspeople often fought back against such riotous behavior with similar results. The college I was a member of at while I was studying at Oxford, Lincoln College, still to this day, once a year, has to pay a symbolic penalty of a fine of free ivy beer. There's the ivy. They make the beer from it. To its neighboring college because it closed the doors in the face of one of that college's students, which while he was demanding sanctuary, and they closed the door in his face, and then he was lynched by a mob of townspeople. So there was a lot of disorder, right? And they needed to work on this. That leads me to the very last point I want to make, which is the corollary to all this, right? That the goal of intellectual wisdom and practical wisdom has to do somewhat with virtue, but they also thought that there was a discipline of living together in a community that had to be cultivated. And this is what John Henry Newman calls the collegiate principle. That's distinct from the university principle. The university principle is all that we've already discussed, this life of learning. But moral virtue is central to the cultivation at the collegiate level. And for them, collegiate was residences, right? Can you be a scholar without being a good person? That was the question they asked. We don't often ask it today, but they thought it was very hard to study well if your life was completely disordered, okay? Certainly if you're riding in the tavern down the block, it's gonna be hard to study, right? So the collegiate element within the university was self-discipline, was meant to foster self-discipline, right? And some of these earliest colleges at Oxford, for instance, are basically quasi-monastic things. They have all that they thought was necessary for life. Chapel, library, dormitory, eating quarters, okay? Eat, pray, love, but eat, pray, study, and love. Right, and the love is love of friendship, right? This love that Newman calls a kind of fellowship that rejoices in the truth. And my final point is actually about this word rejoice, right? Geoffrey Chaucer writes of his, that's the fellowship of college at New College. Geoffrey Chaucer writes of his clerk, a student at Oxford, that he gladly learned and gladly taught, right? And that was the idea that ultimately joy would be at the heart of this experience, both of the university principle and of the collegiate. That should be what's the point also of setting apart all these years for the pursuit of wisdom, but also joy.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.